Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast spotlighting some of the area's most interesting and accomplished women. When multimedia artist and writer Janae Afia started involving herself with Baltimore's community of young artists, something clicked. The scene was often very white, very male, and not always very local. What started out as a Facebook message to a handful of people just to vent turned into Balti Girls, a collective of black and brown female-identified artists. Since its founding by Janae in 2014, the members of Balti Girls have come together on social media and in person to produce what they wanted to see: film screenings, music and art showcases, events, and parties. Janae was born and raised in Baltimore, and she talked about her parents' involvement in the local black art scene and coming from a long line of creative women of color. We also talked about getting woke on Tumblr, collaboration, the meaning and role of safer spaces, and Janae's inspirations. Here's our conversation. Janae, thanks for coming in.
No problem, Quinn. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Well, I just turned 25 2 weeks ago.
I did too, actually.
Ah, really?
Fellow Pisces.
Yeah.
Happy belated birthday.
Oh, you too. I am an artist, a writer, an arts organizer here in Baltimore. I'm from here. So I've spent all 25 years of my life basically living and working and creating here. I do my own work, multidisciplinary sculpture work, photo work, video work, and I also arts lead with Balti Girls, which is a collective of women of color artists based here in Baltimore that's been around publicly since about 2015. There was an early year there in 2014 where we just kind of got together around dinner tables and coffee tables and kind of just really talked about what we wanted to do and what we wanted to see, and then a year later made it happen. So 3 years strong.
Where in Baltimore did you grow up?
Well, I actually kind of grew up all over the place. I was born in the Reservoir Hill area, Utah Street, and I lived there for a while. Then we kind of hopped over further west into West Baltimore, into the Sandtown area. And then we moved to actually Baltimore County, to Essex, and lived with my grandma for like two very wonderful, peaceful years of my life. Being an only child, it was really great to kind of like hang out with her and a bunch of my cousins. And then we moved to the Cold Spring area. So kind of by Sinai Hospital a little bit. So mostly West Baltimore, parts of the county, but I moved back here to attend college. I went to MECA for about a semester and then settled at UB, and that's kind of where I did a lot of my formal undergraduate education before I decided to drop out of college. So I've been back and forth between city and county, but something has kept me here, and I've enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed being close to my family, my friends, some childhood friends. So yeah, it's been an interesting ride.
Is there a neighborhood or a part of town that you claim as your own, even though you've kind of been all around?
Ooh, I would say, I mean, if somebody asked me like where I was from, I would say I'm from Over West, as we tend to say. I have spent a lot of my time since moving back in the neighborhood I was born in the Reservoir Hill neighborhood. I did recently move to the sort of like northeast Baltimore area, Belvedere Square area, and that's the first time I've lived in East Baltimore. So it was kind of like, oh, true, York Row, Harford Row, Bel Air Row. Like all of my friends, oddly enough, lived in that area growing up. So it's kind of funny to be over there. I was like, this is like the area where like your friend who had like a dog and, you know, two parents and like two cars maybe like live. So I feel like I kind of came up a little bit. Like I don't actually have a yard. I live in an apartment still. I'm not quite ready for a full house. But yeah, it's really interesting to be over there because I would like be a kid and be over there and be like, wow, one day. And so I guess one day finally came. So yeah, that's where I live now, and I love it. It's quiet. It's a nice place to have like a little tiny one-bedroom apartment, so I have no complaints.
What do you think has kept you here?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, family, obviously. All of my family's here. All of my immediate family's here. And I mean, affordability. I did move to New York for a little bit, and then I came back to take care of my mom because she was sick. That was about 2 years ago. But I mean, there's nothing like it. Like, you can really kind of have your like side hustle or two and pay your bills. And that's really rare. Like when I left, I realized how rare that was. And I think I appreciate it more now that I came back, and you can kind of breathe a little bit, and you can do your work. You can, you know, get a group of your friends together and start putting on parties or art shows or whatever you want. You can really self-produce here in ways that I think you can't in other cities. I feel like there's a lot of maybe gatekeepers in other cities. There can be a lot of like nepotism or hierarchy or whatever. And here, I mean, of course there is that, but I think it's a little easier, actually a lot easier. It's a good place to get yourself started and a good place to be based. Even if you're gonna travel all over the world or across the country, you always have Baltimore here, and you know, people really love and support you here, like especially if your family's here and your friends are here. Like, people really do want you to succeed. I mean, it's a hard city, especially like being young and Black here. It's very hard, it's very difficult, but you know, people do want to see you succeed. It's not everybody's, you know, maybe out to tear you down, or like it's not a city where like everybody like hates on each other. Like, people really do love you and they give up the love.
What were you doing in New York? Were you making art there?
I turned 22 and was like, I got to get out of here. I had dropped out of college like maybe a year or two before and had kind of worked a series of odd jobs and floated around and started Balti Girls and was really enjoying it, but I was like, I gotta see what else is out there. So I actually got a job working as an office intern, administrative intern for Micheline Thomas at her studio in Clinton Hill, and that was a really amazing experience for me. It was really formative, really taught me how to be a boss woman, how to really, like, you know, make those demands and be about your work and be about your business. And it also was really important for me as like a queer Black woman to see a studio full of queer people, like running the entire show from essentially top to bottom, from the artist to the people who were running, you know, behind the scenes, the office work, the people who were her production assistants. Everyone was pretty much queer, and it was a lot of queer women and a lot of queer Black women, and that was really amazing for me. And I think that made me feel confident coming back here, like being confident also like in my sort of business life, professional life, Balti Girls life, but also made me confident in like an area of my personal life that I wasn't quite necessarily comfortable with. I always say that like my coming out timeline really started there, and then sort of as I matured and got comfortable, you know, I came back home, you know, it continued, but like that was like a really important moment for me to see what I was capable of, what other people who were like me were capable of, and how like you can really use everything that you have to your advantage.
When you were growing up in Baltimore, did you know many Black queer women? And also, what was your knowledge of a local art scene, if at all?
My parents were like very involved in like the Black art scene here, especially like relating to, you know, cultural activities, you know, Pan-African types of, you know, cultural based, you know, activities. I said that already. But like going to things like plays at the Arena Players and the UB Blake Center, and, you know, going to Morgan, to the Murphy Fine Arts Center for lectures and talks and things like that was a really, really big part of my growing up. And I don't take any of that for granted. I think as a kid, you're like, why am I here? Like, you know, what am I? I could be at home playing with my friends. I want to, you know, be eating Hot Pockets and outside like everybody else. But, you know, it was really, really big for me. Like, I remember my mom took me to go see Faith Ringle's quilts one time, and I was like, why? I'm 10, like, take me home. And it was like after school too, so you're like already tired. But like that, all that stuff, even if it's like happening in your periphery, is like you're absorbing it, especially as a kid, you're absorbing it. So I really, really thank them for, you know, exposing me to not only cultural activities, but activities that were based around my identity as a Black child, as a Black, you know, soon to be Black woman. You know, my mom really centered Black artists in our home. I remember one time, you know, I was very creative early on. I used to draw on the walls. Like, if my dad's listening to this, he can tell you that. And, you know, I used to draw on everything and paint on everything, markers, all types of things. And I remember when my mom sort of realized I was like a creative child, she just started buying these books and things from Everyone's Place, which is an amazing, amazing shop that's been around for a really long time. It's on North Avenue in Pennsylvania at the intersection right before you get to the train station, right before you get to Penn North. And they would buy my coloring books from there, my clothes from there, things to decorate the house. And I remember she had like a coloring book, and she bought that for me that was all about these kids who were Black, who were like kind of like traveling all over the world. And, you know, you learned your ABCs and your colors, but these were kids that looked like you. Or there were like Black fairy tale books. It was like Goldilocks, but it'd be like Afrolocks, something like that. And I used to read those, or like getting these little info cards on like Augusta Savage, who was like a famous sculptrix who was active during the Harlem Renaissance that not a lot of people know about. She just was really like, saw that like, okay, I have this like Pisces artistic creative child, like let me foster that, but like let me let her know that like she's coming out of a legacy. And I think that that's been so important to me because that's informed essentially what I do now as like an artist, like, you know, in my individual work, but also with Balti Girls.
So do you think your parents like saw that creativity in you and then wanted to foster it? Or are they the type of parents who hoped you would become an artist before you were even born?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. I mean, I think I like came out the womb pretty much like very like creatively inclined. I loved touching things. I loved like Play-Doh and finger paints. And like I remember my mom, she still kept one of like my little like 1-2-3s math books, and it has like all of these eraser marks in it. So like I really was not into the numbers thing. I was very much, you know, all my coloring books are full. So like I think, you know, it was very clear early on that's what I wanted to do. I think my parents are both very creative in their own right. Like if anyone listening or if you were to see my house growing up or my father's house now, like it was very decorated, like almost like when I went, you know, got older and did undergrad, a little bit of undergrad, like almost what people would describe as an installation. Like that's how like decorated and lush our living room and our entire house was, full of fabric and sculpture and beads and stones and paintings and my paintings. And like my dad used to frame my paintings and put them up. So yeah, like they were really creative in their own right and like maybe never had that formal education, but passed all that they knew on to me because it had been given to them. I think I come from a long line of Black and brown creative people, especially creative women, you know, who were creative from everything or artistic with everything from their dress to their makeup to the food that they cooked on Sundays or every day. And I think I'm just kind of like following in their footsteps, honestly.
What was your experience like at art school and why did you decide to ultimately drop out of college?
Ooh, all right. Well, College for me, I think I was just kind of burnt out. I actually went to a private school here for like the majority of my educational experience, which I kind of really struggled, and I struggled in that environment. So I think by the time I was of college age, I was kind of like done with education. Not that I didn't like learning or reading or couldn't commit myself. I just think I was like done being in that environment. And so I started off college at MICA, and I was really only there for a semester because it was not a place that I could afford to be. It's a, you know, private education costs a lot of money in this country and continues to kind of rise. So I think that experience was also very difficult. And then going to UB, it was like really fun because, you know, I'd been in private school. Like UB was like a public college, and it was like really fun to kind of like sit back and like be in a more relaxed environment and still know like, hey, you can get your work done, but it doesn't have to be so serious. And I also met some very good friends there, really amazing creators and collaborators like Abdu Ali, like Lawrence Burney, there in school, like in class. And so that's really amazing that it's, and that school kind of gave me that or like was that environment for a lot of people. Like it was sort of, it's the type of environment where it can be whatever you want it to be. So it's really kind of cool that we all kind of came together, like all the creative people or the writers or the artists or the musicians kind of all connected and still continue to cross paths. But yeah, school was not really for me. I mean, to be honest, I probably would have dropped out of high school if my mother would have let me, because by the time I was 16, I was done. Oh, I was done. I couldn't. I just was like, please let me drop out of school. I will immediately take the GED. Just like, can't do this anymore. And she wouldn't let me. Like my mom, like I was a first generation college student. My mom had done 2 years at a community college, and my, you know, both my parents essentially had not been able to finish a 4-year degree for a variety of reasons. So my mom was really passionate about me going to college, and that's why I went to private school. But like, I just, by the time that kind of came upon me, I just was done. And I think she had a hard time with me wanting to drop out. Like I hadn't dropped out of high school. She was happy about that, but she really wanted me to finish college. But I came to her and like I was 21 at this point, and so she was like, hey, you know, you're 21, 20 maybe, you're an adult. I don't necessarily maybe understand all of it, but hey, I gotta let you do what you gotta do. And it's one of the best decisions I ever made in my life.
So at this point, were you feeling like you were becoming part of a larger community?
Oh yeah, I think kind of going out and seeing what was happening in what is now called Station North was really important for me. But I think for me as like a Black young Black artist, young Black queer artist, young Black woman artist, it was hard for me to see. It was like a very free and interesting environment, but it was also like really difficult to see like a lot of things happening that were maybe not centering people like myself in this sort of like weird bubble. It was like interesting to see how free that all was and to see like the things that people were making and doing, but it was like very white and very male. And I think going out and seeing that was like, it kind of like something clicked, and I think that's was one of the impetuses for forming Balti Girls, was like, hey, I really love the artistic part of this, but like this needs to be more inclusive. And so that's kind of what got the ball rolling for that. But yeah, I mean, everything from, you know, going out to the Crown, I mean, the Crown's what, almost 3 years old, which is crazy. I remember like the night it opened, to going to places like the Bell Foundry, Llamadon, going to their events was like a really big thing for me. You know, everything from, you know, Beat Trip to Lawrence Birney when he did his Flat Out party, to Kalan that Abdu Ali did, like all of those things were like really important for me. Like it was, not only were those lineups or a lot of the people who were coming through the room like really legendary, and like that's honestly like an understatement, but it was just like really exciting to see that there were people who looked like me who were into the things I was into. I think, you know, it can be hard to be like, you know, into weird things when you're a kid. So to kind of like get older and like have be validated by peers is like really fun and exciting. So yeah, it was really fun and still is fun.
And I feel like it's kind of, it's changed so rapidly, but now, you know, you hear people talk about how there aren't nerds anymore, which I kind of agree with, because even maybe when we were growing up, it was like if you had weird interests, that was still pretty niche. But in the age of like Tumblr and individuality, you can always find your niche interest, I feel. Like, you know, weirdness is a little more celebrated.
Yeah, I also think like the weird aesthetic is more celebrated. Like, I remember, you know, in high school, like, I didn't even like color it. I got like a piece of like purple track, like in my bang. I still had a perm. So like it was like a straight piece of purple bang hair weave sewed in. And like this was like in blonde. So like this was like, oh my goodness. People were like, what is this? Like, and this was like had to be like 2007. Like, so like 10 years ago. Like, and now that's like, I see kids, you know, clearly high school and middle school students, you know, wearing the outfits I wore with whole crews of friends who are wearing the exact same thing. And that's so cool. Like, I'm into it. Like, I don't think being, you know, artsy, creative, nerd or whatever has to be like an exclusive club. It's just kind of more so like funny to see it now. Like, I remember like I got this big pair of glasses. People were like, what is happening? Like, people were so not into it. And then by the time, you know, I turned 25, you know, it's, you know, I can kind of walk out the house like I am today. I know you guys can't see it, like wearing, you know, at least five different colors and like nobody really bats an eye. And that's cool. I think that kind of says like where we've come as a culture, but also how like the traditional gatekeepers of what is stylish and what is cool and what is interesting, like really don't exist. I remember having a Tumblr in high school and nobody was really on Tumblr. It was like very exclusive to like a certain set of people. But also it was like really cool, like how many of us, especially like young Black queer folks, got really woke off Tumblr. Like, I, you know, the proliferation, say that three times fast, of, you know, works by like Patricia Hill Collins and Audre Lorde and bell hooks on there to like then like, you know, late teens, early 20 year olds, like was really amazing. And I feel like it's given us so much, armed us with so much, like intellectually and socially. I think something like Tumblr, you know, or even just social media in general is like the reason why something like the Black Lives Matter movement exists. Like that type of sharing of information, like in the late 2000s, early 10s, really laid the groundwork for a lot of people like really getting woke and getting this information. And then so by the time, you know, 2014, 2015 rolls around, they're ready. But I also interact with like a lot of high school students or a few high school students, and they talk about their identity and social issues and all sorts of things in a way that I couldn't have dreamed of when I was 15 and 16 years old. There's no way. Like gender pronouns.
Intersectionality. I had never heard that. Yeah.
And, you know, it also is like, yeah, that should be something you're talking about in high school. Like, you should, you know, I remember it was a big deal that I had a health teacher in my senior year of college say something along the lines of like, you know, let's we were talking about relationships, and she was like, I don't want to be, she used the word heteronormative. I don't want to be heteronormative and assume that everyone's in a straight relationship. And like, I remember being like, wow, really? Like, you know, like, it was kind of really amazing that she said that, but like, that language is so, that's so commonplace now, or at least in some environments, it's so commonplace. And I think for me, that's like something that I think about a lot, like, how can that become more commonplace in other communities or other areas, like my own community, like the Black community, like, let's have conversations about sexual identity or like gender identity and not having a gender and being genderqueer and, like, you know, being trans, like, let's have more open conversations about that and make, you know, and just kind of like continue that. Because sometimes I feel like in my own community, there can be like a lag, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And I like never want to like get down on anybody for that, because I think there's a lot that you have to deal with being Black in this country, like just trying to actually like make it through the day and like see another day. But I really want those conversations to extend past like a white context a lot of times, or a white middle class context.
So tell me about what Balti Girls is and the founding of it.
Yeah, so actually recently was like typing up an interview and like found our first Facebook message that I sent to like, I think it was like 12 people, maybe less. And it was really interesting to see. It was like, wow, like this is where it all started, like literally online on social media again. Yeah, Balti Girls was really started as sort of a response, like I was talking about earlier, to going out, especially in these spaces that had been deemed for quote unquote artists or young folks or whatever, around, I wouldn't even say the Station North area, but kind of like that general vicinity. And how like it was very white and very white, very of a certain school, of a certain class, many people not local or native or however you want to put it. And kind of like, hey, like, let's just kind of get together and talk. And like a lot of people I was contacting were people who I had maybe even met at MICA, but I was like, hey, some of y'all ain't even in school no more either. Like, let's talk about like how we feel and what we want. And just kind of like, honestly, it was like a spaced event. And then we kind of had a meeting and then we had another meeting and then we had another meeting. And then we were kind of like, oh, you know, let's do an event. Let's do one event. That was literally what we said. We were going to do one event. And it was a screening, because we'd come across a short by a British director, Cecilia Meke, who was gone on to do really amazing things like directing an episode of Insecure. And it was called Aki and Saltfish, and we watched it, and we laughed, and we thought it was great, even though we were like, I don't understand some of this because of his accents, but we just kind of like, we're like, yeah, this is really amazing, let's screen it. So that was kind of like one of our first events, and it was at EMP Collective, and they were really gracious and kind of like let us come into the space and let us use the space and kind of really let people know what we were about. And it was also just like really cool to see that you could put together an event and have people come. Like, that was, I like looked around and I was like, oh, wow, people are here. People actually heard about this. And at that point, we had no Instagram. I think we just had a Facebook page. And it was really cool to see that. And that's really what the mission of the group has been, is to kind of give this city programming that we want to see, that's geared toward millennial women of color, queer women of color, and kind of, you know, because we realized there was like a gap. Like, people come to Philly and people come to D.C. Things happen in those cities. Or like, there is programming here centered around Black identity and things like that, but maybe doesn't have a queer perspective or a young perspective or whatever. And that's really was what was the jumping off point to, you know, we call it platform building and creative safe space, or creative safer space, because I had someone tell me that safe space doesn't really exist. And I think they're right. There are only safer spaces. So creative safer space for women of color. And that's what spawned Edge Control. That's what spawned Black Love, which is actually about to happen next week at EMP. So some full circle activity there. But that's really what got us going, is kind of really just being like, hey, let's produce what we want to see. That's it.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about safe spaces, because it seems like even among quote-unquote progressive people, there is a lot of debate about the idea of safe spaces. It seems to also be very generational, with like a lot of millennials and younger people totally embracing the idea, and a lot of older people being like, you know, oh, that cuts you off from debate. It cuts you off from differing opinions. So I'm curious, what to you is a safe space or a safer space, and what is it not?
I think for me, it's a space where people just feel like they can be who they are. for me, it's a space where I can feel like I can hold hands with my girlfriend. It's a space where I feel like I can speak my mind. It's a space where I feel loved and supported, even if I, you know, if we don't maybe know each other, like that type of energy is kind of being circulated by both the people who are attending, but also the people who are organizing. I think a safe space has a lot to do with the people who organize and the rules they dictate of that space, whether it's like, you know, a list at the door or just what they are and are not willing to tolerate. Like, I always tell people who come to our events, if there's somebody here or something is said or something happens, this is who is in this group. This is me, at least. You can come and talk to me about it and tell me and it will be handled. Like, I think there is a tendency, especially with women, with Black women, when something is said around their safety, we're not taken seriously, like, at all. Especially a lot of times when this relates to other Black people and specifically other Black men. And I really, really wanted to create a space where you could say that and you wouldn't be like demonized, or you wouldn't be made to feel bad, or you wouldn't feel like you had to second guess yourself, because, you know, anything could pop off at any time. Like, you know, anything, you could, something could be said or something could happen, and it happens like that. It happens. These things happen fast. So I just really wanted, personally, on a personal note, to really have spaces where you felt that love, but you also felt supported.
Did you have negative experiences outside of the space that you have created with Balti Girls?
All the time. I mean, I think there is, and I've actually had a lot of conversations recently with my girlfriend about this, and it's kind of about, especially being a femme woman, a straight passing woman, there's a lot that you get trained to do very early on. As like a young Black girl, like probably around 10, definitely by 12, you start getting catcalled, hollered at in the street. You start feeling uncomfortable about your body and how your body, I mean, and you could honestly be wearing a extra large tracksuit that covers everything. Like, you just start feeling like you are the problem, that something about you is wrong and something about you is giving these men, a lot of them men who could be your father, the idea that you are available, that they can touch you, that they can look at you, that they can make you feel uncomfortable. And I think that as you get older, it just continues to happen. You start going to the club, you start, you know, you turn 21 and you're able to drink. It just continues in those environments. And like those environments, especially those club environments or nightlife environments, it can become an even more intense situation, and it can become an even more dangerous situation. Especially because, you know, all sorts of substances are involved that can cloud things, can escalate things, whatever. And so, yeah, all the time. I think I honestly, at 25, am just kind of like getting clear on how much I was like letting things slide and how much I had just kind of become numb to that reality of that portion of my life. Like, you know, the whole idea, I remember I used to like, bad idea, but used to walk home at night alone sometimes, even coming from work. And I had a lot of hair at the time, and I used to like literally pull it back and put a hoodie on because I was like, I don't want anyone to know I'm a woman. I don't want this to draw attention to me, and I don't want there to be something that somebody can grab. And that's like not even as long, like it didn't even take that long to like even put those dots together. It's done. You put your hand up in a bun, you put a hoodie on, and you walk home. It's immediate. It's so ingrained in you. And also so much of the language of your elders, of your mothers, of your aunties and your grandmothers is telling you that. And this is pre-puberty. This is 5, 6, and 7 years old, the things you get told to like literally keep you safe, because we live in a world where like many men feel like they can victimize women and girls. So yeah, that's the long answer. But yes, it's
really hard to balance, I think, like trying to live in the actual world and being safe with like trying to be the example of what the world that you want to be, right? Like, I believe women should be able to walk home alone at night safely, but then it's like you feel like you can't because obviously you're in danger.
Right. And it's like, honestly, it's a situation where it's like, hey, this is the space we've created for ourselves. But also like, yeah, everybody travel buddy system when you go home. Like, you know, it's kind of like as soon as you literally step out the door, like cross the threshold of like whatever space you're in, it's on, essentially. Like, you know, I've been thinking so much about like the amount of missing Black women in this country, and like how like I always like that narrative is a narrative I knew without anyone ever putting an article out about it. I knew that if something happened to me, it was, or anyone I knew for that matter, was a black woman in my life or in my neighborhood or in my friend circle that I or we or whoever was going to have to be the one that looked for them. There's so many instances of, you know, black women and girls not getting things like Amber Alerts or not, you know, all sorts of things. And you see this as a child and you see it in like the national conversation. And it's so deeply upsetting that you can't even really think about it. But I've just been thinking so much on it because there have been, you know, so many missing young girls, especially in like the sort of DC area and even in this area. And like how, as someone who's now past, you know, kind of like getting a little older, like how do I protect you? How do I protect my younger sisters? How do I, can I, like, you know, what is my role in all of this? And how do, you know, how do I just even like keep myself positive and protect myself? But yeah, it's something that, you know, as a black woman, probably from the day you're born, honestly.
Kind of an abrupt transition here, because yes. Yeah, we could go on about this
heavy
all day, obviously. Mm-hmm. But back to the Balti girls, how many of you are there and what kind of work do you guys do on your own?
Let me count, because one of our members actually just had a baby. Ashley, if you're listening,
so
hi, Basil.
Is that a new Balti girl?
Yeah, right. Basil is the new Balti girl. So I'm like trying to figure out who, how many people. There are 7, including myself. And we come from all different backgrounds, mixed media, film, video, sculpture, collage, music, DJing, performing. I think that's something I intentionally wanted, but I was really glad it happened. I was really glad that people weren't coming from the same genres or educational backgrounds or ages. Like, we range in age from about 21 to 29. So we're kind of like the full 20 spectrum right there almost. So it's been really cool to also see how people's individual practices can play into sort of things that happen in the group. Like, people who are DJs and musicians can help run sound for a show, or people who are graphic designers can make our flyers, or people who are video artists can make our visuals for when we have edge control and kind of, you know, projections in the background. Like, it can almost be like a one-stop shop when you need to get an entire event done. So it's been really amazing to see people's practices change over the past 3 years. I know mine has. To see how people's practices can really be applied in like sort of this multi-genre, multidisciplinary, multi-sensory kind of event when you do things that are programming or arts programming.
Yeah, I was curious more about that, like how collaborative is Balti Girls when it comes to your individual practices? Or is it more just a group that gets together to put on a thing together? Or is it more like you're coming together, giving each other feedback on your work and things like that?
We actually don't really kind of like critique each other's work. That's like an interesting concept for a meeting. Like, hey guys, we're going to have a crit today instead. surprise. But we really come together and it's kind of like sort of in a way of like, you know, kind of like a meeting of the minds type of way to really discuss what we want programming wise along that kind of like creative, safer space and platform building model, and come up with what we want to see, and then kind of figure out how we can produce it. You know, whether that's a member making the flyer, to a member performing at the event, to a member, you know, reaching out to a organization or some people we would like to collaborate with. It really is, how can we use our skills from these areas to put on this event? So I know many artist collectives make work together, but we kind of make an event together. We use that work that we make to inform the event and then produce the event. So it's like we do make something together, but it's not necessarily like a painting or a performance piece or something like that.
Are there other collectives out there that are similar to Balti Girls, or did you look to any other kind of group or collective for inspiration?
I think for me, speaking to go back to Tumblr, The Coalition zine out of DC, Fabiola Ching, was really inspirational to me. She actually, I think, was a teenager when she started that. And it was really kind of just cool to see like this Tumblr account kind of like pop up and, you know, see that it was so focused on young women and girls, so focused on being queer, so focused on being like a black woman, brown woman, immigrant woman. And it had like such a clear voice. And that was really amazing for me to see on Tumblr. There was also Museum Mambi, museum mammy, Kimberly Drew, who started the contemporary black art, black contemporary art.
And that like blew up. Yes. I saw stories about that everywhere.
And it's so amazing. Like I've met her a few times, IRL, in real life. And it's been so amazing because that was like when I first got to Mica, that was like one of the first blogs I even looked to like kind of even like look at and just was like, wow, look at all of this work made by black people that you maybe didn't even know about or hadn't really contextualized in that way. Like there's a canon and then some of work made by all different types of people all over the world, men, women, all different types of, you know, genres. So it's been really, that was a really, really inspirational thing for me just visually to see all of that. And there was also, there was a literary zine by the writer Gabby Best called Illuminati Girl Gang that really was really amazing to me to kind of see that because I was also writing a lot at that time, writing poetry and short stories. And it was really cool to see that there was this woman of color kind of putting together a online zine and kind of really speaking in a way that I hadn't really seen a woman of color speak. It was, you know, kind of like absurd. It was funny. It was, you know, all these things that I was like, this is really cool. This is really exciting. So like a lot of that was like online. There is also just like, I mean, so much from the Four Mothers, though, the Alice Walkers, the Bell Hooks, the Audre Lordes, the Patricia Hill Collinses of this world that has, I think, informed many of us pre-birth, like informed our mothers and then like found its way into ourselves and then informed us, you know, going back and, you know, reading things like The Color Purple or her journals. There was actually a book that Alice Walker wrote called, gosh, I'm like blanking on the name, but it's like her diaries during The Color Purple. I think it's the same river twice. I'm like totally blanking on the name, but
we'll go back and overdub it in post.
Exactly. Just let's overdub it or not. But it's a work that she put out that was about her experience making The Color Purple, and it's her journal entries. That is an amazing book if you are talking about process, thinking about process. And as a black woman, like, you know, it also talks about how like black men particularly like really did not like The Color Purple and really like hated her and like really came for her as being a black woman, a queer woman, a academic, whatever. So that's a really amazing book. I am sorry that I'm blanking on the name, but that has been a really important book to me. I'm actually rereading it again. And actually a friend of mine, Janelle Agri, gave that to me. So I think she got it at the book thing. So whoever donated it to the book thing like 5 years ago, thank you. But yeah, just like knowing that you are not the only one who has gone through this experience is really important in whatever form, in the written form, in the digital form. Just, you know, seeing that people like you make work, people like you struggle, people like you love, people like you bleed, whatever, has been really important for me. Because, like, I, you know, we talked about this. It's really, it can be like creation is like really solitary experience. Like it starts with you first and it starts internally first. And like, it's just like kind of like in your mind kind of hanging out. And so you literally have to like birth it. And so it's been kind of interesting to sort of like look at all these different things that I, you know, that have been created, that have been birthed in that way, and see that they were made by women like me.
How would you characterize the Baltimore art scene right now? And has it changed since you started Balti Girls?
Yeah, I think definitely post-uprising things have changed. I think many of us didn't maybe, I think we did what we do because we love it. And I think being in Baltimore is like, or was like being in this place where you could just kind of make something and with your friends and it pop. And it was just kind of like a cool club, like not like an exclusive club, but like a chill club of friends doing things. And I think after the uprising, like so many people kind of wanted to talk to us and interview us and photograph us and come here and really understand what we were about, which is totally understandable. But I just kind of think there was like an energy shift when that happened. And, you know, I mean, I remember telling people I was in Baltimore before that, and they ain't know where it was, or they knew it in the context of The Wire or other things. Homicide, my grandma's favorite TV show. So it was just kind of, it was kind of interesting to see that change. And I think BG, Balti Girls, definitely benefited from it, and many other people did as well. And I think also many of us saw that, like, hey, if you're going to get this shine, please shine a light on somebody else too. Shine, like, don't make it all about you. It's like, you know, I think honestly, like, one of the reasons why people wanted to talk to us so much is like they Google Baltimore and like Balti's in the name, so they were like, oh, who are these people?
SEO guys just really killed it. I know.
It wasn't something I was thinking about at all. I still don't really understand Google Analytics like that, but like
it doesn't seem like it's the point of an arts collective. I think you're good.
Thank you. I just think that a lot of us were like, hey, if you're gonna shine a light on me, like I'm gonna shout out somebody. And even if that was like kind of shouting out each other, like it was just kind of letting or passing something along, like saying no to things. Like there was a point where, you know, there can be a point where you get so many inquiries and so many requests that it can just be hard, and you just like, no, I'm gonna pass this on to you, because everybody deserves a piece. And I think that's something that I always want people to know, and that's something that's important to me, is like everybody should get a piece, and everybody should like really love and respect each other's work. But like, yeah, like there, you know, there's too many things going on in this world to like fight over things and kind of like, you know, just play those games. So like, yeah, like that's kind of like how things changed for us and for me, and to sort of see that all happen, and to sort of see that all happen not far from an area that I used to live in, that I hadn't been in a while. Like a lot of my family still lives over there, but I'm not over there. And to kind of just see that all happen was like very surreal, like to see all of these cameras and people from all over the world. And it was just like, whoa. like you know, I think being from Baltimore, you kind of just like your whole life you've been under the radar. So to be, I mean, on the radar and like almost above it, like it just kind of was like everywhere. It was like a really, really interesting experience, and definitely something like that feeling I won't like forget. I also just remember it was really beautiful outside. Like that week, it was really pretty. I just remember that.
It was sunny and warm.
I just remember that the trees outside my house had bloomed, and it just smelled like that weird oak tree smell that it gets here in like early spring, or like not even early spring, like early late spring or early summer. Like, and I just was like, it's so beautiful, but so many things are happening and have always happened here. Like there's been so much Black suffering here, and it's in my own family even, that is kind of like, wow. But like, you know, it was like one of those moments where like the sun is shining and the birds are chirping and you're like, I'm still here. That was kind of like how that whole kind of week felt to me, and I won't ever forget that.
I'm curious, when you're in a collective of like-minded people, do you guys challenge each other much? Does it ever become an echo chamber of ideas, or how much like push and pull is there?
Like when we come to meetings, we come to really kind of like, it's 8 to 10 mostly, you know, every other Thursday, sometimes back to back Thursdays, but we come to get things done and kind of like touch base and kind of move on because everyone's kind of tired by 10 o'clock. But I think for us, there's definitely been moments where there's been discussion and maybe even challenge. Like we had a really beautiful visioning session in January, and we really got to talk about some things that we hadn't really gotten to talk about before. There were like tears for sure, myself included. And it was like a really beautiful experience. It was the first time we'd done anything like that. And it felt like we had kind of like been through so much together. It was like really great to get everything out in the open. I mean, the founding of BG and like BG in my life like coincides with so many other things. It coincides with me coming out as queer. It coincides with my mother getting sick and subsequently passing away. And like, she was a huge supporter when I first kind of like came to her with this idea, and you know, first kind of like financial resource to get like 200 t-shirts, not even 200 t-shirts, $200 worth of t-shirts printed. Like we had no money. So there were so many things that kind of like on the timeline of my own life. And then, you know, there's other things in other people's lives. So like we had done essentially like a lot of growing up together. We kind of went from being 21, 22 to, you know, or at least me, I was like 22 to being 25. And like, what does that mean? You know, and like it's. But that was like a really amazing moment to kind of like sit back and take stock of all that, like all the highs and the lows and the tears and the laughs, and like traveling out of state together. We went to New York together, and you know, just all these different things. Like it's been really a really amazing journey, and I couldn't have asked to have a better group of women to work with, honestly.
Janae, thanks for coming in today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much, Quinn, for having me. Shanika, she a dope girl. Roxanne, she a dope
girl. TT, she a dope girl, dope girl. Thanks for listening to my conversation with Balti Girls founder Janae Afia. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a weekly podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. If you do listen on iTunes, it would help us out if you subscribed and gave us a rating. We're also on Twitter at FMLTrouble and online at baltimoresun.com/FemaleTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore rapper and past podcast guest TT the Artist. Thanks again, and we'll be back next week. Dope girls. Dope girls. Dope girls. Keep